ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Natasha Mitchell with Big Ideas. It's amazing to think that only 50 years ago, if you were 60, your chance of dying, of kicking the bucket, was the same as an 80-year-old's today. So says Dr. Norman Swan, who has, of course, been charting our changing health for almost that long as a physician and ABC journalist and presenter of the popular podcasts CoronaCast, What's That Rash? And The Health Report. But today's show isn't about dying, no, it's about living and living longer and how developments in biotechnology will help with that project, from monitoring your molecules in real time to harnessing AI. But the thing is, Australia is notoriously risk-averse when it comes to translating promising research from the lab to the clinic to affordable treatments for us all. And so Norman is joined at the recent World Science Festival Brisbane by four researchers at the cutting edge who really want to challenge that. You'll meet Dr. Iris DePaz, the country medical lead and vaccines head of medical for Sanofi Australia and New Zealand, and from the University of Queensland, Professor of Biotechnology Avril Robertson, who is Associate Dean Research and Deputy Executive Dean in the Faculty of Science, Professor Alan Rowan, Director of the Australian Institute for Bioengineering and Nanotechnology, and Professor John Fraser, who's the founding director of the Critical Care Research Group at the Prince Charles Hospital and the University of Queensland, and director of the intensive care unit at St Andrew's War Memorial Hospital. Let's take it away.
There's a negative way of looking at what I'm about to talk about and a positive way of looking about it. The negative way of looking about it is called the Valley of Death. The Valley of Death is where you've got labs all over the world, you've got labs all over Australia who develop new molecules, they come up with something, and in the test tube or in an animal model, it cures cancer or it's a new treatment for heart disease or whatever. It looks absolutely fantastic. And then nothing happens. And so the people with this condition continue to die. And you've got to get across this valley of death to get a product at the end. And then that product's got to get to market and into our arms or into pills that we can swallow or into devices which can be inserted into our bodies. That is a highly tendentious process which is difficult. Avril, talk us through medicinal chemistry, because my experience is that the researchers in the laboratory producing these molecules have not got a clue about medicinal chemistry. Mm-hmm. They think they've got it. Yep. Why can't they get it to market? Just explain this process.
Well, the first part of that process is finding an active molecule in the first place. So our drugs that hit the market today typically were discovered as new molecules more than 10 years ago. Mm. It's a long process. It's a complex process, and there are many steps to it. And so sometimes we find...
Does it need to be 10 years?
No, I don't think it does. I think if you look at COVID and if you look at HIV, both are examples of where the world had a desperate need and a pandemic. Everyone worked together. Money was no object. We can accelerate timelines like never before if we come together against a common cause. And that's what happened, I believe, in COVID and also in HIV with AZT, which was the first antiviral. And so finding a good start point is one part of that process, and we can look to nature for that. So plants fight off infection and diseases all the time, and they do it really well. If they didn't, they'd be eaten alive. We have bacteria, which have to fight for space, and in doing so, they also secrete molecules which are bioactive. And we have venoms in our world, and we're all aware of that in Australia, and we can use those to look at new medicines for pain or for heart disease, and that's happening right now. But turning those into a drug is a really challenging process, and making sure that we have the right tools that can translate those into the clinic quickly is critical. And at the moment, where we do all we can in vitro, that means not in a real animal or human system, before we go into animal models. And those animal models are limited because they're animals, they're not humans. And so one of the technologies that's really exciting at the moment is organoids, is looking at real human mini organs, and we can test our molecules against those. So they are real mimics of the human system. So that is a better way to try and translate our early stage discoveries into something that is actually going to work in the clinic. So 95% of molecules discovered don't make it all the way through the clinic.
I just want to continue in this process, because you're going to have a drug that, well, A, it's safe, B can get absorbed into the body.
Yeah.
It's manufacturable. Yes. So that you can scale. I mean, just talk us through those processes because people don't think about that.
Yeah. So you find a molecule you say that's active and you can see it's active against cells, perhaps. You've got the right molecules, the right shape, it fits the protein that you're trying to target. But that doesn't mean to say the body's going to accept it. Your body is full of an arsenal of different defense mechanisms which are designed to get rid of that molecule. And so we have a number of tests we do to check whether that molecule can survive going through the body or whether it will just be destroyed. And following from that, we need to check whether they're toxic or not. So we have a lot of toxicity testing that we go through, and all of that takes a number of years. Once you have a molecule that really is looking good, you then have to go through what we call IND enabling studies. That's before you get into man, get into the clinic. So that's formal toxicity testing. We need to have large scale manufacture of that molecule. So if your molecule is too complex and you have to spend a whole year synthesizing it and you can't do it on scale, that's not something that's going to hit the market very easily. And so we have to have something that is readily manufacturable and can go through those formal tests before we can ever put it into a human being.
Do you have sort of computerized templates that you know what works and what doesn't work, or is it really still trial and error?
There are predictions, so there are a number of computerized prediction models that we can use, but there is no real substitute for actually testing that molecule in real life.
So Alan, just talk us through those organoids that Avril was talking about.
We will take a drop of blood or a human cell out of you, and then we will convince it to go back to its very first primary state, pluripotent, that very first cell, which was you.
You're turning back into stem cells.
Back into stem cells, right, the very, very first one. And then in an environment, encourage it to grow a brain. And it will grow into a brain. And after 6 months, this brain cell, which is your...
Are you overstating this, that it will grow into a brain or just a lump of nerves?
It will grow in the same rate as a human brain, and it will be the same size at that given period of time as a human brain. And to all intents and purposes, it has built that structure similar to a human brain.
Right.
And of course, there's a much longer process. But then effectively, it has all the characteristics of a brain. Now, if you have epilepsy, we will see that. And this is amazing work by Professor Ernst Wolvertang. You will then see that, and you will actually see...
So instead of having a mouse model of a mouse that has fits...
Yes, we now have
the brain that has
fits. Specific to that person. So then that you go, okay, this is fantastic. But then the other point, which was really interesting, is how do you make sure that that becomes effective in the market, shortening the time? So we paired up with a large manufacturer of robotics and said, we can't just do it as a scientist. We need to be able to mass produce this. So we built the first robotic facility, there's two, in the Southern Hemisphere, just down the road here.
For
organoid production. Instead of getting one or two, we get a tray of 96 of this person. And then we can screen all of these drugs for that. And we found two potential cures for epilepsy for that person. And we come back to it, and what was a really important point, which Avril said, 95% of all the tests and drugs we do fail when we get them to humans because they're tested on mice. And that transfer from mouse to human doesn't work. So Europe has now said, listen, human organoids, we're actually going to use as a first phase. You don't need to do mouse. You can go straight there.
So this is called preclinical studies before you get into...
Exactly, yes. Tests.
So we miss out on animals.
Yeah.
But at some point, Iris, you're going to have to test on real people in a clinical trial. And that's a changing environment too at the moment, isn't it?
I guess one of the challenges we have is how do we accelerate that movement from preclinical to clinical safely, and indeed the type of work that's been done in organoids and also even using machine learning is, you know, helping us to try and identify, you know, increase the probability of success of a product that we identify as with potential preclinically into the clinic. And so you have, you know, the four stages of clinical trials, which is a phase one, which is double check or really confirm it's safe. And then this phase two is really to prove your concept. So you would have a product that you know, for example, in the example Alan's given, you know, can treat epilepsy. You would have a small group of patients that you would test your product in. And then if you are successful in your phase two, then you can move into your phase three. And that one is all about the larger scale regulatory level, being able to prove that this product really does work and being able to have enough data for the regulatory, you know, authorities to say, yes, this product is safe, it works, and then you can take it into you know, the broader population. And then while in phase four, we also continue to study the product, the safety of it ongoing, efficacy, Sometimes you come across new benefits that you didn't identify in the smaller groups.
Phase four studies are hardly ever done.
Oh, well, actually, nowadays they're done for every new drug. That usually regulatory authorities require some level of what we call post-marketing surveillance, or phase four.
So some people are talking about simulated clinical trials. Instead of using, it's almost like the computer equivalent of organoids, where instead of trying on real people, you actually run a computer simulation of a trial. Where does that sit now, and where might it sit in the future?
Good question. So it's preliminary. I would say nobody is going to approve a drug based off a simulated clinical trial, but the idea is to take what's happening in real life in our human-based studies, collect evidence, and to ostensibly generate an artificial human, like a machine learning, you know, version of a human, and actually try and predict
GBT patients.
Kind of, but more at the biological level, to try and see if that artificial machine learning model of a human can help us predict what will happen. So, which is pretty interesting. And as we amass more and more data, and that's probably the rate limiting step with that particular area of work, is that all of our health data at the moment is completely, you know, disconnected, like, you know, what your GP gives you versus what happens in hospital versus what happens, you know, in research. None of the data is able to be connected and integrated so that we can look at it holistically.
Just before I come to John, re-explain to us why it was all able to happen so quickly with COVID-19, because we're living with the aftermath now, which is a higher percentage of the population than ever before don't trust vaccines.
This is a sad statement, but true. So why we were able to do it so fast, you touched on it earlier, we had already some work done with mRNA and with SARS-CoV viruses from a previous pandemic that fortunately in that moment didn't evolve, but there was some work done. Also, we just frankly threw money at the problem. So everybody, normally what the team here would go through and I would go through to get a project approved, to get funding approved, they have all these stage gates and you have to sort of prove that things work step by step by step. And then as you keep going, they give you more money. In the case of COVID, they just said, you have all the money now and run everything in parallel.
So did we take any shortcuts?
No, not at all, really. I mean, what happened, the recruitment was a big example. So one of the pain points I have when I run a phase three clinical trial is the amount of time it takes to recruit patients. You can take years in some cases. We have an example of one vaccine that we're developing right now where it's really, the recruitment criteria is very strict and it's literally taken us 12 months longer than planned originally to recruit. Whereas in COVID, quite literally in a day, we recruited 20,000 patients around the world in all of the sites to test out a vaccine, which is totally unheard of. That massively reduced our timeline. And then obviously the regulatory authorities collaborating with us to run, you know, things in parallel. So they did a lot of pre-work on the regulatory files, so where normally they make us wait in a queue. So there was no step skipped, but what everybody did was actually collaborate and do everything at the same time.
So why aren't we living in a post-COVID era now where we're doing that? So for example, another example, coming back to your point about clinical trials, is the UK answered some clinical questions incredibly quickly in what's called the recovery trial, using electronic records, which we've resisted in Australia because we're nervous about privacy. So we've resisted electronic records, but through electronic records, the National Health Service, they were able to put people on parallel processes. Does this work against this? No, the anti-rheumatoid drug, whatever it was, that doesn't work, this doesn't work. And then they found within weeks that a steroid worked and saved 10-20% of lives. Why aren't we doing those mass trials on breast cancer, brain cancer, other things like that? How come we're going back to where we were?
So Winston Churchill said, never waste a good crisis. And that's what happened in COVID. All these brilliant vaccine scientists, Mike Younger, Vaxis, all these people, they did an amazing amount of work with brilliant patients that gave it. And then the hesitancies crept back in. And in Queensland, we could put lots and lots of money into bionic hearts or whatever, or we could build a football stadium. We'll build a football stadium. And that's the sad reality of it, is if you want to get, what's her name, Taylor Swift up here, you'll get the money for it. If you want to build a new vaccine lab, you'll struggle.
But the interesting thing was about that, and Iris sort of hinted at this, we were already preparing for a pandemic. Bill Gates and the Norwegian government, through the Center for Epidemic Preparedness around the world, had already predicted from SARS and MERS that because of the population dynamics, we were going to have an epidemic. So we had already practiced a year or so before how we could go from the standard age of the time of 3 years to make a vaccine to do it to 12 weeks. So we were already starting because the mathematics told us it's going to happen. You're absolutely right. The economics of it drove us to all come together because it would have, like the plague, I think you used the phrase you used before, we had to do something. Whether that applies to other diseases, we haven't got that critical mass to make it driven.
But it will come again.
Will come again.
And that's why we have to not lose the learnings of this time. And what we did with this thing was we made, again, with the Gates people, we made a dashboard where all the data, and eventually it's been approved by UQ, but the reticence of UQ was phenomenal. We have now got, we can get data in and out of a dashboard that we made for nothing for people across 67 countries. Mm-hmm. Now, COVID's gone, but that's the car, that's the Maserati. The fuel was COVID data, but we've got it there.
Yeah.
So that the clinical stuff, the data will just change petrol for diesel.
So, Avril, the costs, the drug industry, inflates the cost of developing a drug that's been shown. You know, they say it's $1 billion, $2 billion. It's less than that, but it's still a lot of money to develop a drug and get it to market. And governments can't do that. This is something for industry. What are the things that are happening in your middle area, apart from organoids and things like that, which speed that process up so that you've got an affordable drug at the end of it?
Well, I think one of the challenges we have is funding. I think funding to be able to accelerate the pipelines is a real challenge. Mm-hmm. We can accelerate the pipelines, comes down to critical mass. And in a university context, you know, we're applying for grants, we're getting grant funding. It's far faster if we can combine with industry and work together. And I think if we have that critical mass on both sides of the fence, you have the smarts in the universities to be able to develop the technology, and you have the power in the industries to be able to drive it through to market faster than ever before. And I think that's where we need to focus, is to be able to work together with industry, mm-hmm. with our basic science and industry partners to drive it forwards.
But apart from organoids, there are other innovations and disruptors around can speed up the process.
Quantum technology is on the horizon, and it's certainly happening now, and that's a really exciting focus that part of our Queensland government has, is on that quantum technology space. And
do you want to explain what that is?
So that is looking at molecules at their atomic level and subatomic level. So you can look in more detail at molecules and interactions than we ever have been able to before. And so from us, an exciting part of that horizon is, can we better model and predict how our exploratory molecules and our proteins can interact together so we get the right molecules for the right drug at the right time? We can sequence genomes. We can know what kind of targets we're going after, but we need to be able to model those far more accurately, and we can do that, but not as accurately as will be coming with quantum tech. We also have an exciting prospect in that diagnostic space to be able to diagnose diseases quicker and earlier, and even monitoring disease profiles in people so we can better target that through perhaps quantum sensing. So at the moment, if you go and you have a disease, you may be put into an MRI scanner where they look at your body and slice it up, and they can look at it in great detail, but it's quite an artificial system. And so you'll be slid into a machine and you've got to stay quite still, and it's kind of stressful. So that's artificial. The frontiers in quantum sensing, you may be able to wear a device and go about your daily lives, and it can detect changes in your body at the molecular level. And that's real-time monitoring to get accurate data.
As we tend to think, well, your cholesterol's up.
Yeah.
You're one chemical, one bit of chemistry. Yeah. But you're talking about thousands, if not millions, of molecules changed only in a very tiny way that adds up to a pattern.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's a super exciting frontier that we're only just starting on.
So where are you with quantum computing and the potential there, Iris?
So, I mean, we're at the moment still with the machine learning AI space. I mean, quantum computing has so much promise to the point that Avril's made, but it's not yet, you know, accessible even to industry in terms of the being able to have a scientist drive it, if you will. But what we are doing is developing digital twins and also developing...
Can you explain what a digital twin is? Okay,
so it's basically creating you as in a computer model. So to try and, a bit to the point that Avril was just raising, try to predict what will happen, you know, to a person if they're given a certain medicine or under certain conditions. So one of the challenges we have, a little bit circling back to the point about the digital data, is the lack of big data. What we're really missing to be able to make really good digital twins is to be able to have enough data amassed to be able to try and, you know, from testing in clinic, you know, multiple...
The digital twin is as complex as the real person.
Exactly. So that's the trick of it. So currently they're a bit, you know, rudimentary. They're pretty advanced, but they're rudimentary versus the human being, which is really, really obviously an advanced machine and very complex. And it's exactly for the reason that you just mentioned that we want to do it, is to try and predict those patterns early. So, for example, in the area of neuroscience, they've identified recently that people who have Parkinson's disease lose their sense of smell 20 years before they get diagnosed. And so, which is just kind of, for me, it blows my mind.
In the Alzheimer's, yeah.
Yeah, and exactly. And so, but being able to have, you know, the testing and being able to help people predict that early, you can actually potentially, you know, ensure you identify drugs or provide drugs that prevent Parkinson's, because there are some products that can help prevent Parkinson's, to the right patients. What we know is that about 20% of patients who receive them don't need them. But then in some patients who do need them, don't get them. So it's that's the bit of, you know, for me, getting that data, being able to get it, make sure that the right patients are getting what they need, is sort of the critical thing.
I think I'd also like to be able to model the blood-brain barrier in true accurate sense,
yes.
Because there is a barrier around the brain that 98% of all known drugs can't cross it. And so it's a really big challenge for us as medicinal chemists to get molecules that can target Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. And we don't have good models. We have predictive models, but they're not great. None of them are that good. So we do our best. And then you head to the mouse models, which, yeah, again, similar to what we've talked before, they're good, but the translation between that mouse models, which look great, we can cure mice of just about everything, into the human. If the world was run by mice, we're sorted. But they're not. And we need to be able to do that. And one of the exciting things that we found in the company that we have is that some of our molecules can do that. But it would have been great to be able to predict that and to know that. That would have been awesome. So there's a great frontier there that has great hope for the future, I think.
Alan and John, I mean, in the days of Alexander Fleming, you know, he had this Petri dish with an agar plate and he saw this mold growing and he would look at it under the microscope. Now, actually, the mathematician's almost more useful than the biologist.
Well, the physicist.
Steady on.
So I see that you're absolutely right. Everybody's alluded to the same thing. We are complicated people. The biology is really, really complicated. And what we've been doing before, we've been prodding and poking, and then we see something over here or something over there. And we've never been able to look at the bigger picture. So as we have this capacity to process things more, AI and quantum technologies, it allows us to pull out connectivities we didn't have before. And that's really, really important. The physicists are an integral part of what we do every day. I mean, those brain organoids, we've now built a quantum basically sensor around a brain organ. We can now start looking at a brain with a quantum biosensor. I mean, the Australian government has just given to UQ, we are leading in making quantum biotechnology, so we can build sensing cells talking to each other, which we could never do before. So the technology allows us to see and do things we never did before. But again, we are going to require computational programmers, we're going to require mathematicians and physicists, and the old boundaries, and that was one of the reasons that medicine took so long. We were isolated into little ivory towers. This is biology, this is chemistry. The problem, and this is industry, this is university. We've got to get rid of that. And if we make that pipeline easier, we'll start to answer the questions quicker, yes?
I mean, does this take away the art of medicine? The fact that you're actually going to typify somebody, the digital twin, you're mathematically described, and thank you, Dr. Professor Fraser, but, you know, get stuffed.
Oh. Thank you so much. So we've got three Scots on the stage, and you'll notice a lot of the research you're hearing about was invented in Scotland. So just, it's always raining in Scotland, so you stay inside and invent things. So the other thing in Scotland is everything's to do with football. Yeah. And medicine is like football. You don't need 11 strikers, you don't need 11 goalkeepers, and it's about bringing in a team of people that are better than you. It's about the patient, it's not about the doctor. And if the doctor needs a nurse, an allied health, a medicinal chemist, a virus manufacturer, a statistician, it doesn't matter who scores the goal.
A physicist.
Mm. You've got to win the game. And that's why, so our research group that we started 20 years ago, when I started, I would talk to industry and people would go, oh, that's a bit dirty. It's a bit, you should wash your hands. But we're never going to make something. Brilliant things, the bionic heart and stuff. But without industry, you can't move forward. Without the bioinformatician on transcriptomics, you get terabytes of data. I can't do that. I was rubbish at maths. That's why I did medicine. Medicine's a team sport, and it should be. We should be aiming to be Glasgow Celtic, Norman.
And it's a team from the start, I think.
Your turn.
As time goes on, people are starting to question the safety. You talked about phase 4 trials. So you can do a phase 3 trial, and let's say you do it in 2,000 people. If there's a side effect that's 1 in 2,000 or more, then you're going to pick it up in the phase 3 trial. But if it's 1 in 1,000,000, you won't. That's when you pick it up afterwards. Now, we did do a lot of post-marketing surveillance in these vaccines, but people are saying that they're getting odd syndromes, neurological syndromes, autoimmune problems, which were theoretical. Honestly, where are we at with the safety of these mRNA vaccines, and what surprises have there been when they've been used in millions of people? So it might only be a side effect of 1 in 10 million people, but it's there. Where are we at?
So, I mean, they're pretty much the same or safer than the existing, vaccines. So we're not seeing...
There are no specific side effects?
No. I mean, there's other vaccines that create some other side effects, which are, you know, part of the reason we're trying to evolve the technologies to change the platforms that we have existing. So live viral vaccines, as you mentioned, are used relatively commonly, but what we believe we can do better with alternative technologies, like you described, or recombinant adjuvant protein vaccines or other different vaccines, cell-based vaccines, can potentially replace what we made, you know, not quite back in the day of Jenner, but, you know, it's been, you know, in the 40s. So we want to improve on that. But we haven't seen anything with the mRNA platform that's sort of really different from the others. I think the challenge is more the media actually being so involved and so, you know, just talking about every tiny thing that happened and creating a lot of, in my opinion, unnecessary anxiety. I think probably that's the biggest scourge we have to deal with, is the whole disinformation, misinformation, you know, people who aren't medical, you know, doctors or experts, you know, getting a say in public health decision making. To be honest, that's probably the bigger challenge that we have. So it's I think we need to solve for that, because we know that there's greater levels of anxiety in our community and mental health issues, and so somewhere there needs to be some regulation of who gets to say things about medicine.
This is a question for you all. I mean, it's like plenty to go in this discussion, but no, at this point, I should really just bring it up, because distrust of public health is so high that it's going to be very hard to implement vaccines at the level you'll need to control a pandemic. And they didn't, actually, in the United States. So politics covers all over this.
It's all over. I mean, politics is science, just at a bigger level. And I think you're right, the disinformation...
Which was great confidence in politics.
Science at a bigger level. It's a massive problem. You know, polio outbreaks in the States and Byron Bay. Yeah. You know, Salk and Sabin cured it. They gave the vaccine with no patent. They made it free. They changed the world of polio. And people won't take a sugar lump because somebody... you know, sitting in their back decks doing this. You know, there's a great meme during COVID of vaccine research, you know, someone like yourself or younger or whatever doing vaccine research. And then the picture of anti-vax research was someone sitting in their toilet screening Facebook. And that's the level. But because social media has given everyone a voice, and that's maybe good, but there has to be, and that's probably, this is why these kind of things are so good. Yeah. Get science on the front page. Get someone like you doing the COVID report, or someone talking, going, yeah, well, look, the girl from grade 11 that used to sit beside you and pick her nose, you probably shouldn't believe her. And or Mr. Trump, he probably only made grade 10. but it is a massive problem, and they've got a voice.
Jimmy Kimmel did say that he should take the bleach now.
Yeah, that's right. Isn't it past your jail time? I think was the best line.
I mean, as a scientist who's buried there, the politics must be frustrating here.
It is, because you can see the challenges that the public face in trying to understand that science. Because we as scientists, we're embedded in it all the time. We can see the truth of where these vaccines and things will have a real impact on the community. And I find it tremendously sad, that misinformation, that people are going to miss out on real therapies that can really help them. You know, herbal medicine's great, but there's a lot of medicine out there that some herbal medicines that are actually not going to cure you. And there's a number of people who have believed in that herbal pathway. Yeah, I'm not saying there aren't good things in some of those products. We sometimes use that to turn them into medicines that actually are going to have a real effect on disease. And some of these people, by the time they are so sick, there's nothing we can do for them.
And we see that. We see that patients, they say, but our herbalist, and I'm not against, but our herbalist or whatever,
having a hard time.
They're sitting in intensive care, but we believe
this. Who needs herbalists when the chief medical officer of Queensland comes out last week and says there's no such thing on COVID based on a really iffy study?
So again, this is where, the word science just means knowledge. Ciencia in Latin means knowledge. Don't be so categorical until the evidence is out and be open to it, because we learn more and more data as more science goes on.
But the Queensland vaccine was a case in point. I mean, this was was considered, the boss of CSL said it was probably one of the best, if not the best vaccine out there. But we basically threw 100 million doses in the bin because you might have got a positive test on HIV, but not.
Not HIV.
And we basically were saying to people, they won't take it because there is a fear of the unknown. And I think it comes back to what you say. We have to be out there telling people, actually, we don't know everything. This is the best bet that this is going to save you.
Coming back to mRNA, because I got distracted there with all the other stuff.
Sorry, I think
just tell me about the therapeutic applications of mRNA technology.
So one of the things that we're trying to do is combine it with some of the existing immunotherapies that exist, for example, for cancer. So, and I think it was mentioned earlier, they're quite expensive to be able to do that. But by combining it with mRNA, potentially there's two things. One, we can target it really down to you and your particular cancer, because mRNA is very easy to adjust. So with the other technologies, it can take many, different approaches to try and modify from what you have to something more specific to the patient. It can take months or even years to do. Whereas with mRNA, it's a sequence. You just put in the new sequence, and within a day, you can actually have a new mRNA sequence to test out. And so it's part of the beginning of that, personalized medicine, and some of, I know that John's done a lot more work in this space, but it can potentially provide a complementary approach to try and really address, a cancer or a chronic disease much more specifically to the individual patient, as opposed to at the moment, say with vaccines, it's like one size fits all.
John, we've been talking about personalized medicine forever. Is it here?
It's coming.
Yeah.
That's what they've been saying forever as well.
So the way that everyone's body's different, we've all got different coloured trousers, different coloured shoes, whatever. We're all different. One size doesn't fit all. So we need to understand, go right back to the basics of what's happening at the cellular level to see how you respond. So there's cancer. We used to think there's cancer cells and then there's non-cancer cells, but then there's precancerous cells. And the stuff that we're doing at the Wesley with Arutha, brilliant young scientist, and this is about bringing a team together. Mm. You got virologists, transcriptomicologists, and medics. You bring it together, that's where the magic happens. The patient's got to be at the centre of everything. So this is looking at, I guess, a Google Maps technology of a tissue sample or of a cancer. It's important to know how that cancer cell works, but the cell next to it will affect the way that works and whether it spreads or not. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit...
It's a classic problem, pancreas cancer, for example.
All of them. And in fact, cardiac disease and in sepsis too. One person might die from sepsis, the other person goes home with a tablet. So the way we respond is entirely different, and we don't understand from a biological process personalised enough. So we can start... it's like a car driving here. You might have a fast car, so you think it'll be 10 minutes, but if I crash in front of you, then you'll be 40 minutes. So we need to know how the other cell interacts with you. And then also, when we start treating you, like chemotherapy doesn't work for everyone. We wish we knew when it was going to work, but if it's not going to work, we don't want to give it to you and make you sick for 6 months at the end of your life. We want to know it's working, use it or say, we can look at how the precancerous cells are developing and change or just say, go on a cruise. Mm-hmm.
So to Avril and Alan, you can understand and the practical and expense side of doing mm-hmm. it for somebody with a rare form of epilepsy.
Yeah.
These organoids, computer modeling and so on to get to that personalized approach. Is it ever going to be scalable? You could do it for coronary heart disease or even depression, for example.
Well, actually, I think it is. I mean, I think there's a whole package of technologies which are coming along to make medicines more personal. Because when you take a drug, now currently it might work for you, it might not work for you. There are several technologies coming along, certainly in the diagnostics, where we can very early on diagnose mass and try and get the right drug for you. Then when you've taken the drug, we can actually, say within 24 hours, measure your cytokines and say, how is your body reacting to it? And then take you on off it. The other idea of actually making an mRNA which is specific to you take that cancer cell which is unique to you, you pull it out, you make an mRNA, is actually getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. Right. So the idea that these will actually become personalized, like made for you, bespoke within a week, is actually, certainly in my lifetime, that will be there, and it will not be that expensive.
Now if we look at sequencing the genome, you know, yeah. you can today go out and have your genome sequenced for $50. There's yes. many companies that will do that. So that technology has come on in leaps and bounds, and it used to be very, very expensive.
And yet it's not routine at the moment for a cancer patient to have the genome done.
Exactly. Makes no sense. And even if you go into hospital with an infection, they're not trying to find, well, what exactly is that infection you've got to get the right drug, right time, first time.
I mean, my personal hobby horse is that medical research focuses on the negative, the person who's the treatment fails on. It doesn't look at what John was talking about, exactly. The person who goes out with just a pill and survives. What is it about them?
Yep. Yeah. Very good point.
We should learn from. We don't learn terribly well from sex, although there is a project going on in ovarian cancer through Melbourne and doing that. Just talk to me. I want to get on to this translational issue. Yeah. You know, so we're all talking about development, getting stuff mm-hmm. ready, the runway, organoids, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. But at some point, you got to actually put money on the table, mm-hmm. you got to bet on the horse, and you got to take it to market. Just describe what you do at the moment in that process.
So what we're doing with the Translational Hub in Brisbane is we're actually working in the preclinical stage with certain collaborators to try and generate some discovery level medicine because you need to try and understand better the potential opportunity we have with mRNA and also with some other areas as well. But ostensibly what we do is when we identify a potential technology or the drug that might be mm-hmm. viable, it would be about working initially with the investigators to make sure we've got the right level one, phase one data. And to be honest, so for big pharma, mm-hmm. most of the time they don't invest before phase one because it's about the de-risking.
And I might just put you on pause a moment to recognise the people who have gone before.
Yes.
The University of Queensland, and Queensland was a pioneer in drug discovery, particularly from the natural environment and finding useful
molecules. Absolutely. And actually as part of the hub, the key collaborators are the University of Queensland, Griffith University, as well as the state government, so everyone. And I think that's the big thing in terms of making the translation possible is that coalition, the collaboration, we're all co-investing together. We're all taking the risk, and so therefore we're all willing to take more risk and earlier risk and invest in that preclinical to mm-hmm. phase one piece, which is part of that valley of death that you were talking about. So the lack of investment from here, because the way that research works, unfortunately, is as you go bigger into the later phases, it gets more and more expensive because you're having to, include more patients in clinical trials. Mm. It's a lot bigger infrastructure that you need to use, with hospitals, clinicians. I've got to pay John, right? So he's expensive. It just gets more and more expensive as you go. But what we're trying to do in this sort of preclinical to phase one phase is increase our probability of success. And that's something actually that the technology of mRNA can do and other technologies as well, that we can take more shots on goal early before we get into the clinic, and that way improve our chances of actually moving forward in the clinic.
Now we have to bring in the finance story. It does get grubby because you need money.
Yes.
Yeah. And investors don't want to take risks. Yeah. And I think probably people don't appreciate that those early phases, if you leave it to the market will fail you. That's where you get the valley of death. You've got to de-risk. Avril's daily work is de-risking this product so that investors will come in at a later stage and develop it further.
My husband works in the VC space.
Venture capital.
And this is the pain point for me because even though he has a doctorate in biotechnology, he still leaves biotechnology as the last thing he will invest in. And I'm like, that's just mean. Why are you like this? But what he says is that it is because, you know, there's not enough understanding at the beginning of, like, how do you design these things correctly so that an investor would become interesting. But the bigger part of it is most of the people working in the venture capital space or in that finance space are not scientists. So then there's two pieces to that, is how do we as the scientists communicate effectively what our value proposition is, what are we sitting on, and the opportunity, and how, you know, how can we help them meet us in the middle. And so for them, one of the things that they are trying to do now is identify, you know, experts that can sit across both. What I have noticed with philanthropy is that often the wealthy philanthropists are people who've been touched by a disease.
Yes.
Like they have a partner or a family member or someone that something's happened to, which is, I mean, this is the way, unfortunately, we work as humans. We don't care about stuff until we're in trouble. Mm.
Yeah. But Alan, again, sitting from where I sit, observing the system, when people give to medical research, or they're very positive towards government investing in medical, you know, that's what the public wants, is the government to spend money on medical and biological research. But there's two things about that investment. One is getting products which will help patients, but the other is building up smart industries in Australia, employment in those industries. Yeah. And I just watch one Australian innovation after another
leave. Yes.
And setting up in California.
It's a combination of several aspects. We are actually very, very good in Australia in that invention phase. We've got some brilliant scientists across throughout the whole...
When the real money's being made, it's being made overseas.
That's right, but we are extremely conservative here. It's very hard to actually get that money from the venture capital here. I mean, I work often with the venture capital, and they will say, we've got plenty of money, we don't have enough things to invest in. And it's really a risk appetite. I mean, what you'll see in somewhere like Stanford over in the United States, they're prepared to make, you know, only 5% needs to be successful. But those we don't have that mentality here. So what happens is we get it so far, and we do a lot of the fundamental science paid for by the government and the state to a certain point. And then when it's worth something, we go around and we try and pitch it, we don't get the money. And then along comes American company and said, well, we'll do it, and then it's gone. And this is a continual track record which we need to change. But Aris had a very good point, and it relates to the current venture you're doing in Queensland. This is a $280 million investment, which is the government as a partner, it's industry as a partner, it's the university as a partner, and saying, let's build this technology here, let's keep it here, so it can be incubated far enough, so that the manufacturing stays here. And it's a different model. We can't continue on the same model, because we're just basically exporting our knowledge in a very quick way.
And you've got a lot of experience in the device area and other things in commercialization.
Yeah, no, I listened to it and I totally agree. So they talk about research and development, R&D. Yeah. Queensland, if there was an Olympics for discovery, we'd be at the top of the table. But the development, the D, we just don't do enough. So I think it was 2007, a young engineer, Daniel Timms, came to my office, Fernie Grove, born and bred, did his QUT PhD to look at developing a bionic heart. And we set up, he was an Arsenal fan, I was a Celtic fan. Again, it all came down to football. He was next door to me, and I was working on transplanting biological hearts. You know, Prince Charles were the first, David McGiffin, another Scot, his mum was Scottish. We were doing this stuff, and Daniel started working on bionic heart technology. So Daniel's an outstanding scientist, still is. We couldn't get a grant from him here. We bought a sofa for my office, and Daniel, for 9 months, slept on a sofa in my office. And we got some money here, and we did some animal studies here, we showed it worked. It's a phenomenal piece of engineering. So Daniel then went across to the States, and he'd worked and worked and worked, went across the States, and within a week, we got $3 million given to us by a guy called Mattress Mac. And Mattress Mac, Scottish surname. I don't think he was, but let's just go with it.
Sounds a little parochial.
And he gave us $3 million.
Yeah.
And Daniel took the company. I don't really do anything with it anymore, but Daniel took the company over there and got bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, cardiac disease is the biggest killer worldwide, and we do a lot of work with transplants, and we have translated. We can now use biological hearts on a rig to resuscitate, and we've changed the way transplant happens. All from here, we got from animal lab to 36 humans with 100% survival in 4 years. But this kind of technology, we lost, because the appetite for risk isn't here, and the VC people go, we understand money, but we don't really understand the science. And that's where we need a Google Translate Mm-hmm. They're speaking business ease and we're speaking science ease, and we need something on our phone to explain to them that this is a really good idea.
But sometimes the governments say, well, why would we compete with Singapore or China? Can we?
Well, I mean, Singapore at the moment is quite full. Trust me, and there's not a lot of companies I speak to around the world who are investing in China now at the moment. So there is actually a real opportunity for Australia. We do see, as we travel around the world, a lot more interest in coming here. It's a safe place. There's a wonderful smart workforce. IP is safe. So they're looking for places to come in Australia, but we need to have that fertile ground for them to land such that they'll stay. I mean, you know this yourself very clearly.
People see health, or the government sees health, as it's a cost.
Yes.
Rather than it's an investment in us, like, you know, in keeping us healthy. And it's interesting. So I lived in France for about 6 years and it was fascinating. So they have like a fully, I don't want to make everybody jealous, but they have fully blown, everything was paid for your healthcare. If you got sick in France, you didn't pay for a dime for anything. Like, you know, I was unfortunately very unwell when I was there, and the cost of my medical bill would have been about 200,000 euros. I paid $50 for the TV. That was it from my room. That was all I paid for to be cared for. And look, now I'm totally fine, 100% cured, problem solved. So I think for us, the change of mind shift that needs to happen with the government is that this isn't just about the cost of treating patients. Investing in science is an investment. We'll be able to make people better, keep people healthy for longer, and we're all going to live for longer, whether we like it or not. So we got to make sure we get more miles out of this and that we're healthier for a lot longer, and not just see it as it's a cost, something that we need to spend on. And to Alan's point, I mean, the reason we came here is there is amazing science. Australia is a fantastic place to be. My running joke is if we were Austria, or geographically located where Austria is, we'd probably be the global leaders in biomedical research based on our science. But the piece we're missing is that next, you know, how do we get that investment in, and how do we make sure and there's a lot of Australian innovation in being used in medicine. It's just unfortunately marketed or done and executed somewhere else, which is a bit sad because we want to keep the value here.
Mm. Alan, tell us about your Spinifex project.
Well, I mean, it's not my space, it's the indigenous Spinifex project. And I think it's a really good example of translation. That particular grass, it grows in this incredibly high temperature. And then when you break down the grass, it's actually made of nanocellulose, which is like cotton wool. And it's extremely thin. It's 10,000 times smaller than a human hair. But actually, it mimics the hyaluronic acid in your body, the gels and things like that in your body. There's a whole science which had to go in there before this ended up as the first, Triomeda Willinger, which is the first indigenously owned biotech company in Australia. But actually, it cost us, before we got that venture capital, and we had to fight tooth and nail to get something like $3.5 million to get the company up and run, we'd spent $8 million in fundamental research. And that had to be subsidized by the government. So it was a whole development of breaking down the grass, seeing how it is, doing the toxicology, working it all out, building these gels, testing it, showing that it can replace and is much better and less toxic and in your knees for arthritic knees. All of this to get it to a point where somebody would even invest in it was really, really difficult. And to be honest, we had some American companies who said, oh, we'll take it away. And if it wasn't for that it's indigenously owned, they said, no, this is Australian. We are keeping this in Australia. This is going to create jobs up at Mount Isa. Then effectively it would have also gone. And this is that real tragic story, but that pipeline took effectively 12 years. But if you were to think just on a side point, we are setting up the first National Indigenous Science Translation Centre. There is a knowledge out there which we haven't even touched upon of indigenous knowledge of plants and foods and things like that, which could be a minefield of wonderful Australian products supported by indigenous economy. And that's something we're currently working on. But it has the same problems we've all talked about. How do you get something from an idea to a piece of science to actually getting in to help people is really hard.
So that's talking about getting over the practical barriers, which are low-tech in a sense.
Yeah.
One of the issues here, and it just is that doctors can be your own worst enemy. Yeah. So when Richard Scollier, the melanoma pathologist in Sydney, got brain cancer, and he put himself on the experimental immunotherapy trial, I was getting phone calls from cancer specialists saying, how can we stop this? This is terrible. Because, you know, it's as if, because he's a doctor, he's getting special care. And I'm saying, it's because you lot are so negative, you're not doing anything about brain cancer, you've given up.
Yeah. I think he's phenomenal.
We do have a problem of blockage here in the medical profession who give up too early, don't we?
So there is, quite rightly, we're talking about phase one to four trials. You need to do it safely, otherwise there will be problems. But
you're allowed to experiment on yourself.
The game changer. So Charlie Marshall, who the Australian who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the ulcer, the bug that causes stomach. Brilliant fella. He sent his study to show that a bug caused ulcers, sent it into the local gastro society. They rejected his abstract. They accepted 56. They denied 6 of them, and they denied his. He then drank someone else's stomach juice to give himself an ulcer, proved it, and he got a Nobel Prize. So every time I get a rejection, I'm one place closer to a Nobel. You've got to be Pollyanna. You've got to be Pollyanna.
I love it.
And you're working on fungi now.
Yes, it's one of our areas of research. And fungi are not natural pathogens. They like to live in the environment, but there are
some. They're a growing problem.
They are a really big problem. So they are. Pardon the pun. Sorry, I missed that completely. So 6.5 million people have invasive fungal infections, according to a 2024 study, and 2.5 million deaths are directly attributable to those pathogenic fungi. And they are spreading because of climate change. The higher temperatures are selecting for more resilient fungi that survive at these higher temperatures, and they are spreading intercontinentally at an unprecedented rate. And they're really hard to treat. Me as a medicinal chemist, the cell structure of a human being is very similar to the cell structure of fungi. So how do you kill the fungi without killing the human being? And so that's a really big challenge. We have minor differences between those structures. It's not like bacteria and viruses where they're very different. Fungi are very like us. And so that's our biggest challenge, is treating some of these fungi. And they're a big problem for people who are immunocompromised, cancer patients, HIV patients, etc. And they can also form biofilms on medical devices, which are tremendously hard to eradicate. So this is a really big growing problem that is underfunded, underappreciated. And so that's one of the areas we're working on. And even new fungi are emerging. So in 2009... Candida auris was detected in a patient's ear in Japan. And to give an example of how nasty this fungus is, there was a man in the US who went to hospital, and thankfully the clinician realized what it was, which is amazing in itself. They put the man in isolation, and he duly died of sepsis. They had to burn the ceiling tiles to get rid of the fungus. So that's how nasty these are. So if we have molecules that can fight against that, and there are very few antifungal drugs, many of these fungi are growing resistance. Some have no available drugs to treat them. So that's a sobering thought, that we need to fund the medical research. And we've spoken about the acceleration we can have with funding and working together.
Well, good luck to you all. I mean, you're all doing great work. But what we've also illustrated is that the system needs to loosen up and be focused on results. Could you please join me in thanking our amazing panel?
Dr. Norman Swan from the Health Report and What's That Rash podcasts, hosting that World Science Festival Brisbane discussion on new frontiers in medicine and biotech. And he was joined by Dr. Iris De Paz from the biopharmaceutical company Sanofi Australia and New Zealand, and from the University of Queensland, Professor Avril Robertson, Professor Alan Rowan, Professor John Fraser, who's also a researcher at the Prince Charles Hospital. You can find all their details on the Big Ideas website. They're all up to a lot. And you can also find out how to join me at a Big Ideas event recording on our website. Just scroll on down on the Big Ideas homepage and look for Be In Our Audience. Next week, I'm heading to the action-packed Sorrento Writers Festival. I might see you there. And to catch up with all Big Ideas episodes, you can find and follow Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app. Catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.